Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 31. My name is Karen, and as always, I'm joined by Kristen.
It's morning again, so I apologize.
We're also joined by Callie. That was excellent timing, Callie.
That was perfect.
Yeah.
You're learning your cues.
Oh, and she flops.
Let's see if she stays with us.
Yeah, you gonna podcast with us?
Can hang out?
So our challenge for this week is this episode is gonna be roughly an hour long. Because last week's was 2.5, so...
We're gonna try and make this one super quick.
We've made a promise.
To the point.
Yeah.
Get some...
You guys don't get mad at us. Yeah. Please don't get
They're
mad at us.
They're not all gonna be 2 hours.
Yeah.
That is not...
That was just... There was a lot going on.
Yeah.
If you would like to contact us, please do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. We're going to jump right into our news, like usual. Last Olympian week, it's over. We're done.
I'm going to miss it.
I was having a lot of fun doing that.
These were really good fun, and yeah. It was nice, like... checking in every day and talking to people and, like, hearing their favorite quotes and seeing people's favorite, you know, characters and the fan art and all that stuff.
The fan art's always going to be there, but, like, I feel like new stuff was resurfacing that I hadn't seen before, people that I hadn't seen before, and it was really cool. I think we're still going to do some graphic stuff because that was a lot of fun, so hopefully we'll keep putting those up for you guys to enjoy, because Kristen's very good at them, and I like them.
AKA, I have basic graphic design skills thanks to programs that do most of the work for me.
But they look good, and that's all I care about. Okay, so we did have kind of a crazy week in terms of news. It looks like there's a lot here, but it really isn't. I just... want to read some very specific things that Rick wrote. So his first blog went up on May 8th, and he talks about the Victo Nye covers, Ballad and Dagger, Arusha and the Nectar of Immortality, as well as pre-ordering The Last Fallen Moon, which comes out June 7th, so make sure you guys are on that. That's the second book. The first one was The Last Fallen Star by Gracie Kim. And then he talks about his first week at the studio, which is the little more exciting part of the blog. And he talks about how strange it is to reporting for a 9-to-5 job for the first time in 20 years. Like, he thought he was going to be semi-retired by now, and now he's going back to work. And he talks about meetings with, like, 25 to 30 people at a time, making decisions for the show. And that sounds like a lot of people to juggle, but at the same time, I can just imagine, like, the creative collective brain in that room has to be amazing. And it makes me more excited about the show hearing that.
Well, and when you think of all the different departments, you've got everything from the special effects to the decorations and the things that, you know, the set decorations, and then you've got the props department and the camera and the lighting and the sound and the music and everything. Like, it adds up fast. So I'm sure of the 25 people, there's like 23 departments and then a double of like two of them or something. Yeah. You know, like there's so many people involved in making a series come to life like this that it's got to be insane.
And he jumps into a bit of that, and he writes, what cameras do we use? What stunts are required? What equipment do we need? What is CGI and what will be live? Fortunately, I don't have to know all those answers. We have an A-plus team of experts doing the math and physics behind getting these scenes right. I am there for big picture stuff. How should it feel? How was it done in the books? How are the characters reacting? That kind of stuff. Has been a special thrill watching our director, James Bobbin, lead this amazing production. His vision and his sense of humor are perfect for Percy Jackson. I wouldn't know how to answer half those 90% of those questions so
being a major film fan, I don't think I could answer 85-90% of those questions either. Like, that's why you have professionals.
Exactly.
And I'm glad that they are asking him questions like, How should it feel? How was it done in the books?
Yeah.
How are the characters reacting? Like,
yeah.
It's amazing what happens when you let an author answer those questions. Mm-hmm. I'm excited.
Because even if they change something in the show, as long as it's true to the character, it's still going to feel right.
Exactly.
So I'm very happy with that.
Yeah.
Rick also wrote, I also got to tag along on a scouting visit this week where we all climb aboard a shuttle bus and investigate sites around the greater Vancouver area that might be used in the filming of the series. I can't tell you exactly where we went, but if you want a hint, reread the chapter, A God Buys Us Cheeseburgers in The Lightning Thief.
I have visions of them camped outside Pop's Chocolate Shop from Riverdale, because that's in Vancouver.
Oh.
At least I think it's in Vancouver. I think the exterior's in Vancouver. Like, I have, like, visions of them, like, parked outside there with a different, like, motif on the front. And, you know, like, I don't know. We'll see. But that's what comes to my brain, like, immediately is,
yeah.
like, that old diner feel and, like, them sitting in one of the booths that we've seen on Riverdale, like, 80 million times.
Yeah.
And, like, you look out the window and there's, like, a dirt parking lot or whatever. And, like, I could totally see Aries, like, hopping off his motorcycle, being
yep.
a total jerk.
His like, motorcycle of human skin, lest
right?
anybody forgets.
Which we got another reference
yes,
to in
did.
Today's thing,
we
but
did.
We'll get there.
We'll get there. But yeah, this was the chapter where they meet Aries at the diner, and he basically sends them to the Tunnel of Love, so that'll be very cool to see in the show.
Yeah.
Now, he also wrote about the trio. He says, you also wouldn't believe how quickly our young trio of heroes has coalesced into a team. They are doing high-flying stunts, learning their swordplay, fine-tuning their knowledge of Greek mythology and their characters, all while going to school on-site at the studios. And, of course, they have found the best snacks in the break room. If you want to know where the best snacks are, ask a middle schooler. They have counseled me on trying the deluxe hot chocolate, not the regular stuff, and the dried seaweed packets, which are delicious. A certain very funny kid may or may not have quipped, hey, my head is full of that. The feeling in the studio is one of joy and excitement, and the cast we have in place is nothing less than demigodly.
Knowing that Walker is
Walker.
Making jokes like that makes my heart so happy, because
and
that's exactly what we need.
I've seen a couple of fan art renditions of this, and he's just like, hey, my head is full of that, and it's so cute. I love it.
Oh. The whimsy.
Yeah.
The whimsy.
It's okay. Just so pure and joyful.
It is. It's delight.
Yeah. So, now that we talk about joy and
not delight.
Yeah. So, okay. In case you guys don't know, because some of you are not on social media, we know this from a couple of people who have written into us, there has been some backlash with Leah's casting as a black girl for Annabeth Chase, and it's not the entire fandom, but it is some part of a group of people who don't have their hearts in the right place. And I feel like Rick very subtly responded to this in this first blog post. He writes, all that said, I am delighted to hear about the overwhelmingly positive response to the casting announcements. It is well-founded. Rest assured, these actors are 100% my choices, my decisions, and I could not be happier with how things are going. If you have any doubts, wait until you see them act in the show. You'll quickly see why I chose them and why I am so confident. Which, first of all, 100% my choice, my decision. Amazing. You want to hear that out of an author working on their adaptation. He also says, oh, and a cool random fact I came across this weekend while rereading my Greek mythology. For inspiration, I often do this. Going back to the earliest source material and also reviewing seminal works like Joseph Campbell's The Power of Myth and Greg Nagy's The Ancient Greek Hero in 24 Hours. Did you know that the gray and gray eyed Athena doesn't necessarily translate as color? I liked the idea of her having stormy gray eyes and always described her that way in my books, but the ancient Greek term, I'm not going to try to pronounce that.
I was going to say, insert characters that are not English letters.
Yeah. Can also be translated as bright-eyed, as in wise or perceptive, and shares a root with
another
Greek
word.
Oh, that was in unison. Which means owl, Athena's sacred bird. In other words, Athena has bright eyes like an owl. Who says they have to be gray? Not this owl. Which I find fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and again, feels like a very subtle hint at, okay, so maybe you know, Leah doesn't have the right eye color, but it doesn't matter because if you go back to the Greek roots, it never is supposed to be gray-eyed Athena, just bright-eyed Athena, really. And I think that goes with Walker, too. Like, Walker doesn't have the quote-unquote right eye color for Percy Jackson either, or the right hair color, but it's not about that. It's about their acting abilities and their personalities and bringing these characters to life on screen in the best way that they can.
And I mean, we've seen people's reactions to casting for other series before, and Percy Jackson is no stranger to this, because like when the original cast came out, people were upset about Annabeth and Clarice, and they were upset about some of the casting then even. This isn't new, we're used to this. I mean, even when Hunger Games came out, people were not happy with Katniss at first, and you know, like...
Or Rue, but that was the same...
Oh, and definitely Rue. Yeah,
that was
absolutely
the same reason Leah's getting hate, too.
Yeah, so like, this isn't new, but it's also not okay. Like, and these are kids, and the things that Leah's had to deal with have been garbage, and I'm glad that he is standing up and saying, like, you know, look at the, you know, looking all the way back to the Greek interpretations of things that I read and took one way and didn't even realize what I was writing into the books, but it's absolutely, you know, appropriate and meaningful to this entire, to the character. It's, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. It's cool to see Rick say, like, hey, these were my choices, these were my decisions. I wrote these books. I see Annabeth in Leah. That is why she is Annabeth. It doesn't need any... You don't need anything else. Like, that is why this decision was made. Like, let's see her as the character.
Yeah.
Let's see her do her job, because apparently she impressed Rick.
Yeah.
And if she impressed Rick, I'm good.
And she beat out tens of thousands of other girls to get this role. I mean, there's a reason why she got it. So...
Exactly.
There's that. Now... I don't want to, you know, linger on the hate that Leah's getting too much, because we try to just be really positive around here and supportive, but she has been getting harassed online. She had a TikTok account that got mass reported and taken down. She started a new one. That one got mass reported and taken down. Rick, I don't think I wrote about this in here, but Becky or Rick, I can't remember which, I think it was Becky, said about how Disney, there's a dedicated social media team from Disney to help these kids, and they're helping Leah get her TikTok account back and that sort of thing. So hopefully we won't run into that problem anymore. But as this was kind of all going down, the fandom was sort of like, we really want you guys to take a stand on this. And I feel like I get that, I do, but Ashley said something really great on their Twitter the other day, which was basically like, I am very angry about this, but my number one priority is keeping these kids safe, and I don't want to fan the flames, and I think that's kind of the stance we're taking too. Like, I see the stuff that's going around, and I get very, very mad, not only because it's racist and misogynist, but also because she's 12 years old, and no kid deserves to go through that.
Yeah.
But I don't want to stoke those flames. I don't want to make things worse. But that being said, I'm really proud of Becky and Rick for taking such a strong stance on what's going on. Neither one of them pulled many punches. So I want to read a couple of Becky's tweets first. She wrote, a while back, you, the fans, and I agreed to make these handles as kid-friendly, safe places as possible. We give no room for demagoguery. We focus on the positive. We are supportive and uplifting. We encourage fans to not give space to hate speech, veiled or blatant. She also wrote, I will also tell you something I know is a fact. Rick's books open people's minds. We get letters all the time that tell us this. Our TV show can do the same. Yelling at haters will get us nowhere. Do not give their hate fires oxygen. That do not give their hate fires oxygen really kind of resonated with me. I really liked that.
No, it's, yeah.
Then she wrote, demagoguery is a good word to know. Do we need to have a talk about the intersectionality of misogyny and racism? Misogyny is equally a problem here. We condemn both. Getting yelled at, Annabeth doesn't belong to you. She never did. Leave Leah alone. Hashtag PJO cast deserves respect. And I really like this idea of, you know, Annabeth didn't belong to the people who don't see her in Leah. I think that's what Becky is saying here.
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't deserve to have Annabeth if you can't move past this obvious racism and misogyny. Again, just really proud that they have said this, but even more so was Rick's May 10th blog post, which we weren't expecting because it was 2 days after the previous one.
Right.
But you could tell he's very upset at the way that people are reacting to Leah, as I think everybody with two brain cells is. So he wrote, "If you have a problem with this casting, however, take it up with me. You have no one else to blame. Whatever else you take from this post, we should be able to agree that bullying and harassing a child online is inexcusably wrong. As strong as Leah is, as much as we have discussed the potential for this kind of reaction and the intense pressure this role will bring, the negative comments she has received online are out of line. They need to stop now." By the way, I'm only taking snippets from the post, basically just the big parts that I wanted to touch on, but definitely go read it if you're interested, because he doesn't pull any punches, yeah. Like I said.
Yeah.
I also linked to a video here that when he said, "As strong as Leah is," it reminded me of a video that's going around from, I believe it was her live that somebody recorded, where she basically says, to all the haters out there, like, just stop. Like, I know you're trying to hurt my feelings, but it's not going to happen. I'm confident. Everybody else is confident. Just stop. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, 12 years old.
I was going to say, I'm 30 years old, and I definitely would not respond that way to the internet.
Yeah.
I've definitely cried because I've had terrible comments on an article I wrote. And those have nothing to do with my hair color, skin color, things, you know, that she's proud of, you know, things that make her who she is. Like, I can't even. I'm in the corner crying with one bad comment. So, like, to get inundated with all of that and to not, and, you know, to have her team, you know, behind her and telling her, like, you need to just ignore these people. They aren't worth your time and energy. And for her to put that back out into the universe, it just, so mature.
Yeah.
So wonderful. She is. Like, she's lovely.
I agree. We're big fans of Leah already, and she hasn't even been on screen yet.
We haven't even seen her. Like, we've seen pictures. That's about it.
Yeah. Okay, so Rick also wrote that the true nature of the character lies in their personality. You feel I must have been coerced, brainwashed, bribed, threatened, whatever, or I, as a white male author, never would have chosen a black actor for the part of this canonically white girl. You refuse to believe me, the guy who wrote the books and created these characters, when I say that these actors are perfect for the roles because of the talent they bring and the way they use their auditions to expand, improve, and electrify the lines they were given. Once you see Leah as Annabeth, she will become exactly the way you imagine Annabeth, assuming you give her that chance. But you refuse to credit that this may be true. You are judging her appropriateness for this role solely in exclusively on how she looks. She is a black girl playing someone who was described in the books as white. Friends, that is racism. And let me just say, a lot of celebrities, a lot of other authors, I feel like they wouldn't necessarily take this strong of a stance. I feel like a lot of them would be like, hey, she's 12, stop bullying her. Like, don't do that. Be nice. Like, spreading joy. Like, he is flat out saying, this is racism and you need to stop.
Yeah.
And I wasn't surprised by it, but I was just like, thank you for taking such a like, not pulling any punches, for just saying that out loud.
Yeah. I've also seen a lot of discussion of, like, Rick's writing and how when the first book came out, there was some discussion of how there wasn't enough diversity in his books. And if you look at the books he's put out since then,
mm-hmm.
they have become this really vivid, wonderful world full of people of color and different neurodivergencies and all these sorts of things, you know, and sexual identities and whatever.
Yeah.
That I'm so glad he is taking the time to let people know exactly how he's seeing what's going on. Mm-hmm. Like, he's, you know, you can see how much he's grown and how much he's learned from starting with Percy Jackson and seeing what people wanted in these books and in middle grade books and saying, you know, here's what I can do, and putting his books out and then saying, here's what I can't do, and creating RRP and letting, you know, people who are way better equipped to tell their stories, tell mm-hmm. their stories. Like, it's just, you know, it's just another reason why I love Rick so much, is because not only is he, like, willing to say, like, I'm not perfect, mm-hmm. and I'm learning, but he's also willing to say, like, here's what I've learned.
Yeah.
And here's why you need to learn what I learned. Yeah. Like, here it is.
You can really, like you said, you can really see how he's grown over the years, and I love that. Because you're right, he wasn't perfect, like, he's made mistakes, but he's talked about those mistakes.
Yeah.
And he's really tried to make sure he grows as an author over the years. And to me, that is more important, like, recognizing that you did something wrong and then trying to change it, I think is the most important thing that you can do, especially if you're white and straight and a guy. And not only did he do that in his own writing, but he's taken the time to give his platform over to other people and uplift those voices that aren't normally uplifted. And yeah. That is a fantastic thing. So yeah. I get very frustrated when people get mad at him for, like, not being perfect or right. not recognizing how much he's grown, because you can only do so much.
Well, and this might sound bad, but I don't mean it badly at all. It's hard to see the things you're ignorant of until you become unignorant yeah. of them. Like he can't address his own biases until he has a chance to see them. Mm-hmm. And he put out the Percy Jackson original series, and he kind of, you know, through other people's eyes, saw what was missing and what could make his worlds more rich and wonderful. And then he's gone on to change that. Mm-hmm. Like, and this is just another step of the way. Like, he's like, you know, if I had known what I know now when I wrote these books, maybe Annabeth isn't a white girl. Maybe, you know, I changed the way I write some of these characters. Right. Because, again, he was writing what he knew and he was writing where he was at the time. And since then, he's gained a whole lot more, you know, exposure to the world and seeing things that he hasn't, you know, didn't know at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I really am just proud to be a fan of his because yeah. of how well he handles all of this and how well he has taken his own criticism, and right. that's wonderful.
And speaking of, the next thing I wanted to read was him saying racism/colorism, which I, again, very glad that he pointed that out in addition to the racism. Racism/colorism isn't something we have or don't have. I have it, you have it, we all do, and not just white people like me, all people. It's either something we recognize and try to work on, or it's something we deny. Saying I am not racist is simply declaring that you deny your own biases and refuse to work on them. Again, everything we just said.
Yeah.
So fantastic. Really love that he said that. The last paragraph that I wanted to read from the blog says, if you're still upset about the casting of this marvelous trio, then it doesn't matter how many times you have read the books. You didn't learn anything from them. Again, pulling no punches here. Watch the show or don't. That's your call. But this will be an adaptation that I am proud of, and which fully honors the spirit of Percy Jackson and the Olympians, taking the bedtime story I told my son 20 years ago to make him feel better about being neurodivergent and improving on it so that kids all over the world can continue to see themselves as heroes at Camp Half-Blood. And that's honestly, what more could you want than that?
Yeah.
You want Percy Jackson, you want everybody to be a fan of Percy Jackson, you want them all to see themselves as campers at Camp Half-Blood. Even just the line about, you know, this will be an adaptation that I'm proud of, that's all we've wanted since yeah. those movies came out. It's all Rick's wanted, yeah. and I'm happy for us because we get to enjoy it, but I'm also so happy for him because this is his dream come true, too.
Yeah. And he's been involved every step of the way and will continue to be involved and is working 9 to 5 every
yeah.
day, getting it done. And that just, you know, it's so lovely knowing that, you know, he's not just a consultant that they kind of touch on, you know, mm-hmm. when the moment strikes them. Like, he's on set every day. He's talking to them. You know, he's a part of the whole thing. And that's, again, all you can ask for.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. The other exciting thing is that Alexandra Daddario said she's excited for the new Percy Jackson series. And she also tweeted again, I think as the Leah stuff was going around, she said, Leah Jeffries will be an amazing Annabeth. And I just, she's so cute. I really like her as an actress. And
I do too.
She's been in some really cool things. And I'm just so excited that she's being outwardly supportive of yeah. Leah, and because I feel like some people will see that and go, oh, okay, maybe I'll give it a chance.
I mean, you know? She was the first embodiment of Annabeth, how, you know, no matter how imperfect it was, and right. we've gone on time and time again about how the actors weren't responsible for the disaster that happened. Mm-hmm. But, like, she did a great job, and we all loved her Annabeth. And now I love that she's, like, excited to see the torch get passed on from the musical, which we saw another Annabeth, and now, you know, to the show that will have a different Annabeth. And that's, yeah, it's just awesome to see her as excited as we are.
Yeah. And if you want to be supportive, there is a hashtag going around, hashtag Leah is our Annabeth. Mm-hmm. So that's very nice. Yay.
Yay.
Ending on some good news, happy birthday to Kwame Mbalia, who celebrated on May 12th, so that's very exciting.
Happy birthday!
He apparently bumped his head as he was taking a selfie.
I saw that.
Did you see that? His smile is so big and cute. I really loved it. So I really liked that a lot.
I know that pain all too well. Not from taking selfies, but, like, when I'm reading things while I'm laying in my bed, I drop my phone on my face.
Oh, God, that hurts,
too. Well, and then I just kind of laugh because I'm like, yep, you did it again.
Yeah. The Last Olympian was also published on May 5th, 2009, so we got another little anniversary. Lots of those books came out in May, apparently, so.
Yeah.
There's that. Okay, let's get into our discussion. We are talking about Percy Jackson and the Stolen Chariot this week. This is a short story that takes place between the Titan's Curse and Battle of the Labyrinth, so we wanted to get to it before we start in on chapters 1 and 2 of Percy Jackson and the Battle of the Labyrinth. All three parts are on Rick's blog from 2007, which just seems crazy to me, but that's very interesting. At the top of the first one, he wrote a little blurb here that I thought was a cool little, like, time capsule back into time. Finally, a sunny day in Texas. So he's not in Boston. In Texas, I thought I would celebrate by posting the one and only Percy Jackson short story. That's gonna change. Percy Jackson and the Stolen Chariot. This was originally written as a promotional piece for the release of Titan's Curse and was available only on a special bookstore mailing list, but now you can read it here. A little Percy to tide you over until book 4. Part 1 of the story is below. Parts 2 and 3 will be published over the next week, so stay tuned. I hope you enjoy. So I thought that was kind of nice.
Yeah.
It was a little fun. Okay, so when does this story take place? So according to our timeline, which I believe I got off the fandom page, it is between Titan's Curse and Battle of the Labyrinth. And at first I was like, does this feel right? Because I wasn't sure, because we were just in wintertime for Titan's Curse.
Yeah.
But then I got thinking about it. So apparently Titan's Curse takes place over winter break and Battle of the Labyrinth is around June.
Right.
Because he's going to see what school he's going to go to in the fall.
Yeah, he's going to orientation, but there's still a couple months before school starts. Yeah.
So this is somewhere in between.
I will say that reading that story, it didn't necessarily feel like a perfect fit. Like, there were some things where I was like, wait, is that how they would react to this? Is that how they're, you know, like, Clarice and Percy, like, is this where they're at in their relationship? Like, it took me a minute, because we haven't spent a lot of time with Clarice in Titan's Curse, because she takes off very early in the book and is gone, and it isn't until the very end that we get a little touch of Clarice, right, you know, at the end of the book. So, yeah, I was kind of, like, mentally scraping backwards, like, what do I know? What do we know about Clarice? Mm-hmm. You know, all of that. So, it absolutely fits, but if it doesn't feel quite right to you, it's probably just because we're in a jumble between the three, trying to, like, figure out where everything fits.
Yeah, because I was trying to figure out, we know she has that new scar on her chin, and she has, like, shaved her head or cut her hair or something like that, and there's no mention of that in the short story, which is fine, you don't really need that. He's also still at school, so he's at the same school he was at in Titan's Curse, and then I don't know if we ever find out if there's a reason why he leaves that school and then goes to good for Battle of the Labyrinth.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we know.
He didn't blow up a school.
Oh, but you know what? He's in high school now, so he probably had to switch.
Yeah, from middle to high.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe it all makes sense.
See, look at us.
We just need to trust Rick.
Right?
He knows what he's doing. Okay. So basically what happens is Clarice shows up at Percy's school fighting these demon birds in an alleyway, and he's like, I'm going to puke. Can I go to the bathroom? And the teacher's like, yeah, just go. And so he goes to help, which of course she doesn't appreciate. But she is desperate because her immortal brothers, Phobos and Deimos, which we learned about a couple weeks ago, Aries' sons, mm-hmm. are playing a prank on her.
Which, by the way, she did not know this was Percy's school. She was just dealing with Phobos and Deimos, and Percy looks out the window and sees Clarice fighting some birds and is like, what is happening? So I think it's hilarious. I love that, you know, Clarice is just doing her Clarice thing, and she ends up right outside Percy's school.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I thought there was a really interesting distinction here between Phobos and Deimos, because Phobos' fear and Deimos' terror, and Percy is like, what's the difference? So apparently Phobos is more like personal fear, like the things that you personally are afraid of, whereas Deimos is better at freaking out entire crowds. And I thought that was such a cool explanation.
I mean, it is, yeah. Like, Phobos, phobias, you're thinking about, you know, the things that scare you, and Deimos being, especially in their physical description, like, Deimos is, like, this big, stocky, you know, he's supposed to be a scarier guy, mm-hmm. is better at large-scale things that scare everyone, and the word terror has become really common when we think about terrorism. So, it makes total sense that Deimos would be way more effective at trying to scare large numbers. Like, terror kind mm-hmm. of fits into that idea these days.
I kept thinking of, like, mass hysteria and, like, what's that phrase? Like,
Crowdthink?
Yeah, something like that, where there's another phrase for it, I think, but basically, like, everybody just starts panicking, and their panic, you know,
herd mentality.
Yeah,
something like that, yeah.
Where it just keeps escalating when you're in a crowd like that. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was pretty interesting. So the whole idea behind this story is that Ares let her drive his war chariot, and it's basically a test. And Clarice says it's usually a ritual just for Ares' sons when they turn 15. I'm the first daughter to get a shot in a long time. And, like, I know Clarice is a bully, and I totally get that, but, like, I'm kind of rooting for her. Like, as these books go along, I think she does get better, so you're meant to like her a little bit more each time. But I was like, wow, like, as a daughter of Ares, I don't know if that's, like, rare or not, but she's kind of shown that she's better than a lot of other girls, and probably a lot of the boys, too. And I was just really proud of her for getting that shot.
Oh, heck yeah. Especially after the events of, like, Sea of Monsters, where things did not go her way, and her dad was being quite the jerk.
He was so mad at her.
Right. Like, so for him to see that despite all of that, and despite some of her personal failures, like, she still has a lot to offer him as, you know, one of his children, and is willing to give her a shot at something like this, I think just goes to show, like, Clarice has a lot going for her. She's not two-dimensional at all, which a lot of, like, side characters and, mm-hmm. and, you know, peripheral characters can be. She's...
Yeah, and especially bullies. Like, bullies are usually two-dimensional.
And she is, yeah. And she definitely classifies as a bully, especially mm-hmm. in the beginning of the series. So, yeah, it's interesting, mm-hmm. but definitely cool.
Yeah. And so her brother's chariot jacked her. I love that, like, Percy was like, they carjacked you? She's like, chariot jacked? And I thought that was just really funny. And if she doesn't get it back, she's going to be in big, big trouble. So she has to return it to Ares' temple by, I think it was, like, sundown. His temple is the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum, which is located on the west side of Manhattan on Pier 86, 12th and 46th.
It's the Intrepid.
Yes.
Like, it's a aircraft carrier. I've been on it.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, okay. That's cool.
Yeah, my brother and I toured it when we were in New York. So, like, I have, like, a visual of being on this giant ship and, like, the planes that are on the deck and all that stuff.
Well, you were in Ares' temple,
right?
Then.
Apparently.
You didn't even know
I visited
it.
And had no idea.
I thought it was just really cool that, like, it makes sense that this would be his temple just Absolutely. Because of the military history and all that kind of stuff. So I thought that was really neat. Again, just an interesting twist on how this world works and how things have been transformed to the modern era.
Well, and, like, if you think about it, like, there's not a lot of places in New York where you would consider, like, a Temple of Ares to kind of be. Like, there's a lot of history, but it's mostly, like, Wall Street kind of things and stuff, you know, like, things like that, more financial and whatever. It's not necessarily a war center. We kind of think more of that as you go down the East Coast and you look at, like, Yorktown and Atlanta and all of that. So you would think his temples would be further south or something like that because there's a lot more battle down there. But the Intrepid is a perfect way to kind of have a temple to him in New York because it's absolutely a bastion of war and all of that stuff. So
yeah.
It's just cool.
I just wanted to point this out here. Like, let's remember, too, Ares is super abusive. Like, we realize that in Sea of Monsters. He's definitely a physically abusive father. And there's a reason why she's terrified not to return this chariot. And I like that Percy, you know, remembers this. Like, he doesn't question it. And, yeah, he doesn't always get along with Clarice. But he doesn't even really hesitate to help her. Like, he's just immediately, okay, let's go. We got to do this. How are we going to figure it out?
Yeah.
And she's kind of at her rope's end. Like, she's about ready to give up. And he's like, stop thinking so negatively. And I really love that about him.
The power of Percy positivity.
Yeah. So Phobos shows up, and when he finds out who Percy is, he seems surprised and maybe a little wary. He's described as being a little nervous. I love that. He's an immortal being. He's the son of Ares, and this little demigod, son of Poseidon, has him shaken in his boots.
And it's the name Percy Jackson.
Yeah.
That, like, instills a little bit of fear in the god of fear himself, and that just makes me really happy.
I know. It was unexpected, but really cool. And to think, this is only right after the third book. By the time we get to the end of, like, Trials of Apollo, Percy is super famous, and he's done, especially in Heroes of Olympus, that series, he's done so many things.
Yeah.
And I just love that, you know, people are a little afraid of him now.
Even the gods.
Yeah.
Even the minor gods. Maybe right? Not the major ones, but the minor ones. They've got some respect. I like it.
So they kind of figure out that Staten Island is where they think her brothers hid the chariot. So they head that way, and Deimos shows up on a sea monster that looks like a giant crocodile. We don't really get an idea of, like, what this is or if it's an actual mythological being or what. But I loved when Percy said, that's one good thing about sea serpents. They're big babies when it comes to getting hurt, because he, like, slashes at it and then it just dives back down to the bottom of the sea. And I was like, that's so funny. He's talking crap about sea serpents. Right? They're just big babies. So they do end up finding the chariot at the zoo. And it's how it was described in Greek mythology. It's red and gold with four fire-breathing horses attached to it. It's described with, like, scenes of battle and death all along the side. So it sounds really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, like, I laughed out loud at this part.
Agreed.
It was so funny. So Percy says, I guess the mist must have been really strong around it, because the chariot's only camouflage was a handwritten note taped to one of the horse's chests that said, official zoo vehicle. Like, I just love that it was taped to the horse's chest.
Not to the wood of the chariot. Just slap a little tape up there.
It was so funny.
This got me, too.
Yeah, it was great. If we were doing favorite lines or moments, it would have been this
right,
one.
The whole thing. This moment right here is it.
I also found it interesting that a little girl named Jessie could see right through it. She could see the horses.
I know in other fantastical worlds, kids usually have the ability to, like, see through illusion easier.
They can see ghosts easier.
Yeah, and so I was trying to remember if Rick had ever established that, like, mortal children can see through the mist a little easier because their minds are more open. So, like, I'm curious if Jessie could see through it because she was so young, or if Jessie has, like, Rachel Elizabeth there kind of abilities, you know? Because we know there are mortals who can see through the mist, and there's just no explanation for it. But I also kind of think that that is a part of this world that, like, kids might see things a little more as they are.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I loved the mom in that whole moment was, like, kind of going, like, zombie and was like, no, child, it's just an official zoo vehicle. See, it says right there.
Yeah.
Let's go. And just, like, drags her kid away. You can tell it's the mist making mom kind of act weird. But it just cracked me up. So it's like, yep, see, official zoo vehicle. Like, the mist is doing its job. Even a half-hearted attempt to, you know, cover it up is great.
I actually had the same thought about Jessie, too. And I couldn't remember him ever saying that. Not saying he hasn't, but I kind of assumed that she was like Rachel Elizabeth Dare, and that maybe I thought it would be really cool if someday some girl named Jessie shows up and becomes a part of the story and is like, I figured it out or
Rick
something.
Rick decides to write a demigod tale from the point of view of a mortal who can see it. So we get Jesse, who's immortal, but gets thrust into this world and, you know, doesn't have a godly parent. But, oh my gosh. In case you needed ideas, Rick.
Right, exactly.
You did plant Jesse into the world already. Go for it.
She's there. Yeah. So Phobos runs Percy down with the chariot, and when Percy looks into his eyes, he sees his worst fear. It's basically Camp Half-Blood on fire and all of his friends begging him to make the choice to save or destroy Olympus, which is from the Great Prophecy. So you can tell that the Great Prophecy is really weighing on him. Even though in Titan's Curse we saw him voluntarily take on the prophecy, he's still very worried about it, which I'm not going to blame him for.
Anyone would be.
Yeah. But the best part was that the fishies helped him snap out of it.
Yay.
And then he ended up defeating Phobos, who wasn't that great of a fighter. And my main question here was, do we meet Phobos again in the future? I don't remember.
I feel like maybe we do at some point in the series. Like, for some reason, Phobos is standing out as a name that we address at some point. But I couldn't name it right now. I'm also wondering if maybe he makes an appearance in The Last Olympian as Ares kind of comes back
maybe,
to the forefront.
Yeah.
You know, it's when we get more Ares, I could see him bringing his sons to battle or something. And so maybe Phobos is a part of the big battle or something that I just, you know.
Right.
It's a minor detail compared to everything else that goes on in the middle of The Last Olympian. So,
yeah.
We'll have to keep an eye out.
I just think it would be kind of cool to, like, because Phobos basically leaves and says, "You haven't seen the last of me." And it would be just cool to, like, tie up that loose end and get to see him again and have Percy defeat him again.
Mm-hmm.
So he's defeated, and Deimos was with Clarice, and Deimos is pretending to be Ares and saying that she failed him, which is her worst fear. And Percy talks her into standing up to him, and when she does, he basically disappears. He's also a terrible fighter, by the way, so I thought that was kind of funny. They're both awful at that, because they rely on their powers of fear to defeat their enemies.
Yeah.
And this was just kind of a nice moment. There's a little bit more of a moment later, but the fact that we know Clarice's worst fear is her father and disappointing him and the consequences that come with it, the fact that Percy saw it and the fact that Percy still supported her and stuff like that and helped her defeat Deimos was really cool.
Yeah, and there's a whole thing in here about the power you give fear.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Phobos and Deimos were giving her a lot of trouble, and that's because Clarice wasn't able to, like, take the power of those fears that they were showing her away. Like, she wasn't able to get her head around it by herself. But when Percy kind of steps in and helps her to get a grip on her fear, their power kind of,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's easy to defeat Phobos once you aren't looking at your worst fear right in front of you. So it's like, there is a thing about, like, giving your fear power and, like, taking, you know, stripping it down to what you're scared of and knowing that, like, you can be afraid and also not give it power over you. That,
right.
There's a whole thing.
There's a whole thing about anxiety and phobias stuff. And, like, I still haven't quite figured that out in my own life, but, like, it's a good thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, I liked that, ultimately Phobos and Deimos weren't, like, that strong. They just use these weapons that are really scary against you. And
it's more manipulation than actual, like, physical intimidation or anything.
Agreed, yeah.
Okay, so they take the chariot and they ride the waves back to the Intrepid Museum, which I thought was cool, and Percy was, like, very tired afterwards, but his powers are clearly growing and he has a lot of power over the ocean.
Yeah.
And Clarice has trouble saying thank you. They turn in the chariot and everything's fine, but Clarice has trouble saying thank you, but Percy kind of knows that she means it. And I love that he didn't need to rub her face in it or anything. He was just like, I get it. And he also tells her that she was one of his friends in his vision who was begging him to make the choice. And, like, she specifically asks this, like, was I there? And he was like, yeah, you were there. And I got, like, super emotional. We talked about this before in Sea of Monsters, where they kind of got a little bit closer in that book. And I was like, wow, I don't remember caring this much about Percy and Clarice's friendship, but I really want to see that.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Yeah. Watching them go from this, you know, bully victim mentality, which is definitely how it starts, to more of, like, a siblings that fight mentality. Like, it's, you know, because I have brothers and we fight like cats and dogs. It's part of our love. I think it's common and as a motif between, like, friends or whatever that you kind of, like, rib each other and you know each other's sore spots and, you know.
Yeah.
It's that kind of, like, they're emotionally closer and they get each other and they know where they're at, and that is only helping things like this, where Percy steps in and helps her, but doesn't, like, take over, helps them to just get closer and closer and closer, and it's, it's really nice.
And I think you're right, their dynamic has changed a lot, because it was a bully-victim dynamic, and now it feels more like rivals, which isn't great, but is definitely better than bullying victim.
Yeah.
But it's like, Percy is definitely one of the biggest campers at Camp Half-Blood. He's done a lot of stuff. He's kind of getting a little famous, and he's very powerful as the one of the children of the big three, whereas Clarice is always on top of her game when it comes to, like, capture the flag and all the physical events, the chariot racing, all that kind of stuff. She is a competitor, and she's not going to let Percy forget it. And I just love that, you know, they're rivals, but that animosity, that, like, hatred that they had in the beginning is slowly kind of fading away. And I can't wait for the moment where they both realize, like, oh, wait, we're friends now? Like, it's going to be,
like,
really
I guess
great.
We can be friends, as opposed to just kind of, like, friends.
Yeah.
Also, I wanted to very quickly talk about this ability of Percy to, like, make the water solid enough for them to drive on. I just thought it was a really cool manipulation of his power. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, we've seen him use the water to travel. We've seen him use it to stay alive. We've seen him use it to save people and, you know, to send Grover and the Ophio tourists to New York. And, like, we've seen all these things. But we haven't really seen him do something like this before. And so it's just a cool another way for him to use the water.
And to turn the ocean solid enough to drive on. Right. Has to take a lot of power.
He's not Elsa. He's not letting it going and the water turns to ice.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Like, he's, like, rearranging molecules so that it's solid enough for the car to be supported and get across. Like, that's insane.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's really cool.
And it wears him out, too. Yeah. Which is also nice to kind of see, like, he's learning the extent of his power. He's learning what it takes and what the toll is, which is all good to know before you go into a massive battle, which we know is looming.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. I think it's really cool to see the stages his powers go through and how it grows and grows. Because I don't think it's necessarily something that I paid attention to the first few times that I read it. It was just like, oh, okay, like, he's getting stronger. But I don't think that was, like, an active thought. Whereas now we're discussing it so closely, I'm like, oh, it's really obvious that he's just getting more and more powerful.
Definitely agreed.
Yes. Okay, so that's that for Percy Jackson and the Stolen Chariot. Glad Clarice got that back on time. Now we're going to be jumping into book four. I always get excited when we start a new book.
I know.
Percy Jackson and the Battle of the Labyrinth. Take it away, Kristen.
Okay. So, obviously, we're starting with chapters 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Woohoo!
I suggested we should start with 6 and 7, but she didn't like that very much.
I mean, it might make things difficult. Yeah, so we're starting with chapter 1, entitled, I Battle the Cheerleading Squad. Percy is at a good new school. Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
You couldn't help yourself.
No, I couldn't. I went for it. Okay, back at it. Sally is dropping Percy off, and they have a chat about his Nada date with Annabeth that afternoon. She's coming all the way from camp to go to the movies. Then Percy sees a familiar face outside his new school. Rachel Elizabeth Dare. He goes in another door and runs into a couple of creepy cheerleaders who tell him they've been waiting for him, never a good sign, and Paul Blofus, who's just trying to be supportive. Time for an orientation assembly. The notorious R.E.D. and Percy slip out and have a chat about a few things instead. He gets her up to speed about what she's seeing and as much about how the mist works as he can. They get interrupted by Tammy and Kelly, the monster cheerleaders Percy met earlier.
I'm sorry, the way you tilted your head when you said that, like you were peppy cheerleaders, was so funny. I wish you guys could have seen that.
They're Tammy and Kelly. This school year, which doesn't even start for another couple months, begins like so many others have for Percy, with a monster battle and him fleeing his new school after having made a pretty big mess. He escapes, but not without making it look like he's a crazy murderer, and only after hearing one of them mention that camp is going to burn. He runs into Annabeth outside the school, where she also meets Rachel Elizabeth Dare. She's not exactly chill with Percy's new friend. Especially since it's obvious he has just told this mortal all about demigods and the Greek stories being true. Annabeth is not a fan. Date is off. They need to head to camp instead to see what's going on.
Congratulations. This was a short, brief recap.
It was actually shorter.
Yeah.
It's shorter.
It fits all on one page on my screen. So.
Yes, those last couple were full pages all on their own. This is just so much... Gosh darn it, Rick. Makes it impossible to summarize. Anyway, I mean, in the book, it's like 13 pages. So the fact that I can get into a brief paragraph is a skill I hopefully will be able to use somewhere else in my life. So let's just kind of jump on in here. When we get to Percy and we're, you know, seeing him with his mom, they're talking about this not a date.
Yeah.
Sally keeps calling it a date, and Percy is, like, insistent that they're just hanging out, and it's not a date, but they're going to the movies together, and it's cute.
It's totally a date.
It makes me happy that, despite the fact that she's been in San Fran, like, they've clearly been in contact because he knows that she's back at camp, and now that she's at camp, she can come visit, and they can go catch a movie, and that's good fun.
Yeah.
Just makes me happy. Anyway, Rachel Elizabeth Dare! A.K.A. the Notorious R.E.D., and I will be using that, I
swear. One of the best things that have ever come out of your mouth, honestly. I cannot stop thinking of her as the Notorious R.E.D.
It's who she is. Deep down in her soul, she is the Notorious R.E.D. Yeah, and I'm always gonna, like, say her full name.
It's hard not to. Like, it's just, that's who she is.
Yeah, it just adds this extra punch, and yeah, there's just something about it. You can't just be like, oh, it's Rachel, like... Who's Rachel? Yeah. Rachel Elizabeth Dare. She is all three names.
Yeah.
Just like Madonna is one, she is all three.
Yes.
It's just how it works.
Exactly.
So yeah, we get a bit of Rachel in this chapter. Not only do we see that magically she is in New York, like what? I loved the confrontation between her and Percy where she's like, did you think I lived at the Hoover Dam?
Yeah.
And he's like, actually, I kind of did.
Yeah. It was very funny.
Like, it's so Percy to just, like, see her there and be like, oh, that's where she belongs. Like, in my brain, that's where I met her. That's where she is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, she's a person, and they visited there, and she's not from there. So, ta-da. She shows up in New York.
Yeah.
Just good fun. But, yeah, how do you feel about Percy telling Rachel Elizabeth Dare about these things?
Well, so I have quite a few feelings about this, I think, because starting at the beginning, Percy has thought of her from time to time, which the way he was saying it sounded like he was trying to convince us that he didn't have a crush on her, but at the same time, like, I kind of feel like he doesn't know what to do with her because she's kind of loud and in your face and special, and he's like, oh, and, like, she's a girl. So it's just kind of an interesting dynamic there. At the same time, I think that her ability to see through the mist makes him uncomfortable because even he can't see through it as well as she can.
Yeah, I don't think I ever really considered that he had, like, some sort of crush on her or anything. It's totally possible and valid because he's a boy and they're teenagers and they're figuring everything out. So, you know, whatever. I think I always just assumed that it was this, like, her being kind of an anomaly in a world full of things going exactly how they're supposed to, you know, like, well, never going exactly how supposed to. But, like, you know, him knowing how the mist works and expecting mortals to see things and him knowing that he can count on the mist to do this. And then he's at the Hoover Dam and there's this mortal who's like, what are those things chasing you? Why do you have a sword? Why are you stabbing me with a sword? Why didn't the sword stab me? What is going on? Like, I think that is enough to just have her kind of stand out. Plus, she's got this, you know, Harvard sweatshirt on, and when he meets her, like, her hair is big and curly and red and, you know, all these things. Like, she, you know, she's bigger than life, and I feel like that makes her stand out in his mind. Uh-huh. Like, he can't quite just dismiss her as another mortal because there's something about her that doesn't quite sit right. And so I think that's why my brain always thought he was kind of... Occasionally would think of her like, yeah, I wonder what was going on with that.
There was one line in there specifically about how he was like, you know, I would think of her from time to time. And then he kind of like rushes through his explanation as to why. And I think that he doesn't really understand it either. And I don't necessarily think that he has a crush on her, but I also think he's questioning why he's thinking of her so much.
Yeah.
But I do think that it comes down to the fact that she is an anomaly in a world full of anomalies. So that's, you know, strange and something that's going to stick out. I felt kind of bad for her in this chapter because she's basically thought she was crazy for all these years because she's been seeing these things for years and has told nobody. She's 14, just like Percy, and she's told no one.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Like, no one's seeing the things you're seeing, and you can't seem to figure out how to tell people, like, you know, they're just going to think you're nuts. And if, you know, so she's just kind of seeing these monsters on a probably daily, weekly basis. She's in New York. I mean, I imagine there's quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's seeing these things often and is just like, okay, let's get on the subway. Like, I'm not getting in that car. Like, well, you know, go to the next one or something. You know, I can just, how she's not crazy, like legitimately crazy. I don't know because I'm pretty sure I would be nuts by then.
It must have been really tough. I always think of the Constantine movie with Rachel Weisz, and she plays twins, and the one twin who continuously saw things was in a mental institution because you can't see these dead demony creatures and not go a little bit crazy all the time. So, you know, just how it is. But to answer your question from 10 minutes ago, how do I feel about Rachel, about him telling Rachel about all of this stuff, I don't think he had another choice. I think he had to. She could already see everything, and she knew, she gathered enough information just for being around him twice for like a total of 5 minutes that he was kind of different too. And I think it would have been more dangerous to ignore that, and like she would go digging on her own and maybe get herself into trouble, whereas maybe now he has a new ally and he can help her come into this world. And I mean, it's not like she's just some random girl. She can see through the mist, like,
right? Yeah, I agree with you. Like, I think because she can see through the mist and therefore has been exposed to this world that everyone else is ignorant of, like, nobody knows that these Greek monsters are out there and running around because the mist disguises them. But she can't, the mist doesn't work on her. So she's already aware of the world. She just doesn't know what it is. So the fact that, like, Percy tells her, like, oh, you know Greek myths, you're seeing the monsters. Even that alone would probably be enough to make her go, okay, so I'm not crazy.
Well, even her reaction to that was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
The Minotaur. Like,
yeah.
She starts naming them all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm with you. I think this was absolutely kind of a necessity. She needs to understand what she's looking at. We know that Annabeth doesn't have the best reaction to this, but I think that comes from more of, like, a jealousy perspective than it necessarily does from a she's immortal, how dare you tell her anything perspective.
Yeah.
Because I think if she was thinking critically about the situation, she probably would have done the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, information is power, and in this case, Rachel needs the information so that she can have power over what is going on in front of her. Just my two cents. Anyway, okay, so let's get to the battle, because we've got these cheerleaders.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that they are Empusai, or if there's just one, it's an Empusa, and they're servants of Hecate. As we kind of see in the battle, they kind of have some qualities that, if you're, like, a Vampire Diaries fan, might kind of come off. Like, they seem to kind of be luring Percy in with, like, their wiles, their, you know, Empusai wiles, I guess. And it almost seems odd, and then Rachel kind of, like, breaks the spell a little bit, and he's able to get a hold of himself and stop them and all of that. And so it's easy to see that, like, the myth of the vampire is kind of based on them, or it's involved. Like, these two fantastical elements are kind of combined their related.
I wasn't sure if they, if it was just them being like, yeah, vampires are totally based on us, or if that's actually true, if that's like part of where that myth came from. Because we know from a lot of stories that these things kind of pop up similarly in different places. They might have had some influence on each other, or they could have just come up organically through something else. So I didn't actually go and look it up, but I'd be curious what the timeline is for that, for like actual vampire myths versus,
you know. I would bet they're probably related. Again, they probably some all kind influence. Of popped up around the same time where different cultures were looking for explanations for this and that, and so they all kind of went, here we go.
Yeah. But I found their creation was particularly interesting because they are a little bit different from the vampires that we know and love.
Oh, yes.
And basically, they're pale with pointed teeth and red eyes. Not all that different. But they have one donkey leg and one bronze metal leg. And the one says, dark magic formed us from animal, bronze, and ghost. We exist to feed on the blood of young men. So men particularly, too. Yes. And I was just like, okay, interesting throwing that donkey leg in there. Yeah. Like, you know, why not?
It's definitely one of the more interesting monsters we've come across. Yeah. I mean, you've got minotaurs that are half this and half that, and you've got, you know, flying furies and all that sort of thing. But, like, they're kind of an amalgam of, like, all these different pieces, and it's very odd, and if we, you know, when we get this far in the series, I'm interested to see an Impusai, like, on screen, because that's going to be insanity, just saying. Okay, so Percy battles the Impusai, and long story short, they use their, like, ability to kind of manipulate people to make it look like Percy kills one of them.
Oh my god, like, literally, like, sets her on fire and then flees the scene.
Right, like, and Paul Blofus is right there.
Yeah.
Like, not great. Not a great way to start the year.
Especially because he and his mom had just talked about not bringing Paul in on what's going on just yet.
Yeah.
And then this happens, and it's like, well, there goes that plan.
Right? He's gonna need to understand that Percy is not a brutal murderer, and that these are not children that need to be protected. Yeah. So, yeah, clearly Paul's gonna need some honesty here. But yeah, so Percy survives, and the Impusai don't die. They don't poof. We learn in the next chapter that they disappear. Like, they...
Yeah, the one poofed. But the other one basically set herself on fire. Like,
and it's like how she... Like, she can travel, or like...
Yeah. So she's not actually dead. Away.
Yeah. So yeah, there's still an Impusai out there. Whatever. We'll deal with that later. But yeah, so this doesn't exactly bode well, and Percy kind of needs to get the heck out of there. And so when he runs outside, they run into Annabeth, and that's when all of that happens. And then him and Annabeth make a quick decision that, like, they need to go to camp. Date is off. Mm-hmm. We need to figure this out, because one of the Impusai says that camp is going to be on fire. Like, she doesn't go into a lot of detail, but she kind of mentions to Percy, like, you're going to see your camp burn. And, like, it's a little alarming, so they decide time to go to camp.
Yeah, I wrote in here, Annabeth is super jealous of Rachel Elizabeth Dare, and Percy is very bad at explanations.
Yes.
But on the flip side of that, I really liked that Rachel basically was like, I'll cover for you. Like, immediately gave him her phone number and ran away and said, I'll help however I can, without really necessarily getting a confirmation that he would fill her in on everything.
Yeah.
So I think she put a lot of trust in him very quickly, and I liked that.
I agree. Yeah. And she writes it in Sharpie on his arm, like,
yeah,
here's my phone number. It's all down Percy's arm. I just, again, I think it's hilarious. Okay, so that takes us to our favorite quotes and our favorite moments. Karen, do you want to go first?
Sure. Mine was the first line of the book. Rick is so good at coming up with first lines for books. And this one just said, the last thing I wanted to do on my summer break was blow up another school.
He's so good at it, though.
Yeah, he is. He's gotten a lot of practice in.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Okay, and mine, this is not abnormal, is not a single quote, but it's an interaction between Percy and Rachel Elizabeth Dare. And Percy says, look, this is going to sound weird. Do you know anything about Greek myths? And Rachel Elizabeth Dare says, like the Minotaur and the Hydra? And Percy goes, yeah, just try not to say those names when I'm around, okay? And Rachel Elizabeth Dare says, and the Furies, she said, warming up, and the Sirens, and Percy goes, okay, and kind of, like, stops her mid-sentence, and I just love that, A, she's so excited and thinking back and trying to recall all the names, and he's like, okay, but I haven't told you about how their names have power, and you need to stop saying them right now, or we're going to have bigger problems than the two in Pusai who just tried to kill us. It's, yeah, it's just really fun, and I love that quote, so good times. Okay, and then your favorite moment.
Was Annabeth showing up and immediately wanting an explanation for Rachel Elizabeth Nair, because I feel kind of bad because Annabeth is worried. She has nothing to worry about, but you could just tell that these two definitely have feelings for each other and they aren't quite admitting it out loud yet.
Well, and considering how torn up Percy is about her relationship with Luke, I like that it's not just one-sided where he's the only one seeing threats to their, like, possible friendship and more. And she's also kind of seeing Rachel Elizabeth there and being like, do I need to be worried about this girl? Like, is she competition? Like, you know, all that stuff. So I just like that she gets a little jealous.
That's a really good point.
Just a little jealous. Mine was Percy's hesitancy when he first sees Rachel Elizabeth there outside the school. Like, it honestly, my favorite part is the Annabeth part, but you already took it. So, but I like that when he first sees her, he's just kind of like frozen, like, what is this chick doing here? And then it's like, Mom, is there another door? And he, you know, goes in the other door. So I did like that she has this impact on him in that moment. Like, it's just kind of a fun, like, wait, did I just see what I thought I saw? Is that her? Yeah, that's her. Okay. Okay, so let's do chapter 2, entitled The Underworld Sends Me a Prank Call. So they take a taxi cab to camp, and Annabeth is a little standoffish after the R.E.D. confrontation. They make it there, though, greet Peleus, and then go on their separate ways when Annabeth says she has to go find Clarice, because they've been working on something together. Wait, what? Percy looks around for Grover, but doesn't see him, and ends up in the amphitheater where he meets Mrs. O'Leary, the Hellhound, and her handler, the new swordmaster, Quintus. Next, it's off to the woods to see Grover on trial in front of the Council of Cloven Elders. Once there, Percy meets Juniper, Grover's dryad girlfriend, who's hanging out with Annabeth and Clarice during this whole proceeding. The council, after some urging from Chiron, gives Grover one more week of searching for Pan before they take his searcher's license. Grover is distraught, but accepts the ruling. Percy catches up with Tyson in his now clean cabin, and then sees Tyson at work at the Hephaestus Forges for a bit, showing off all his new skills. Then they visit with Annabeth down at the lake. Percy then fills Tyson in on a few things, including who put the giant crack in the dining pavilion floor. Tyson quickly grasps the story of Nico, and it reminds Percy that Tyson is no dummy. That night, Percy has a dream about Nico. He is camping at the edge of the River Styx and is talking to a ghost about his frustration at not being able to bring Bianca back, or even summon her ghost to talk to her. The ghost tells Nico that in order to bring her back, he must provide a soul in exchange, and not a soul Hades will eventually collect anyway. He talks about vengeance for Bianca. Percy puts the pieces together. Nico will come for him. Nico might try to kill him. Dun, dun.
Yeah.
So, what are Annabeth and Clarice up to? That was, like, one of the first big questions for me. As she's like, hey, I gotta go. Clarice and I have a thing. Like, they don't get along. And I think it's interesting that they're working together. Especially after the Stolen Chariot thing with Percy. Like, it's interesting to see that Annabeth and Clarice's relationship has also grown.
I feel like, honestly, if those two could get past their differences, they would actually make a really good team, and it must be something that they both find very important that they want to work on and realize that they can work together and actually be a good team. So I'm actually really interested in this friendship and seeing how it develops over the book.
I mean, Athena and Ares, that would be a bit of a punch. If their daughters can be on the same side, that would be interesting.
Definitely.
Okay. So then Percy keeps moving on and he meets Quintus.
Yes.
Well, he meets Mrs. O'Leary and then he meets Quintus.
Which one are we going to talk about first? Because I have to gauge my
emotions.
Maybe
we should talk about Mrs. O'Leary first since we technically meet her first.
I love Mrs. O'Leary so much. I do not remember who Quintus is, to be perfectly honest.
Neither do I, personally.
He's definitely given me a little bit of Hagrid vibes.
Well, it's like Hagrid plus what was the Tantalus? Like, he's got a bit of that, like, Tantalus weirdness where, like, I don't know if I'm supposed to like you. I feel like you're
up to something.
Right. So it's a little bit of that, but he's also, like, really good with Mrs. O'Leary and has a bit of that, like, she's a hellhound, but she's so sweet.
Yeah.
You know, Hagrid vibe. Oh, my gosh.
Get the Greek. Get the Greek. I thought that was so funny. Mrs. O'Leary is adorable, and I love big dogs. My favorite dog is a Great Dane, but I used to take care of Newfoundlands, like 16 Newfoundlands. They are very large, large dogs, and I love big dogs, and I want a Mrs. O'Leary. Maybe I will get some sort of big, what are they called? The Fang, the type of dog that Fang was in the movies.
Oh, okay.
One of those, Mastiff. They were a different kind of Mastiff. Yeah. Actually, I think if I ever get a Newfoundland, I'm going to name it Mrs. O'Leary.
Or Mr. O'Leary?
Both.
Like, it would just be cute. Like,
I don't even care if it's a boy or a girl. Well, its name is Mrs. O'Leary.
And that's what I was thinking. Like, even if it's a girl, call it Mr. O'Leary, because it's like, they go with Mrs. O'Leary. Yeah. I wasn't talking about gender norms. I don't care about that. But I was just like, it would be cute, because it would be like, Mr. O'Leary is Mrs. O'Leary, and it's cute. And never mind. Anyway. Yeah, no, I was happy to meet Mrs. O'Leary. I forgot this is kind of how we meet her, because she becomes so kind of linked to Nico in my mind from things that happen in the future,
right.
and Percy has a lot of dealings with Mrs. O'Leary too, that I forget that she shows up on campus. She shows up at camp with Quintus, and we don't know who this Quintus guy is, but we'll get more about that later.
Well, he's also the first adult half-blood we've ever seen.
Very true.
So I thought that was really interesting.
At least in the books, because we read the other short story that had the
Hal. Right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
The demigod that was trapped in the house.
That's true. That's true.
But in the books, I think this is the first adult.
Right.
Yeah. So, good to know. I also wanted to talk about when Chiron shows up and Quintus is there, he's, like, super flattering to Chiron.
Master Chiron.
Yeah. And Chiron is kind of, like, not offended by it at all. Like, he tells him, like, it's not necessary. But he also kind of, like, stands up straighter.
Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, it makes you think about, like, he's not Tantalus, but, like, it makes you think about, like, is he a good guy? Is he using his, like, ability to kind of flatter as a way to get in good with Chiron and then do something bad? I don't know. I don't remember this guy, so we'll see what goes on with that in the future. Just someone I'm going to keep an eye on, for sure. Next up on our list is Grover, because from Quintus, Chiron kind of gives Percy a ride to go see Grover, who's deep in the woods in front of the Council of Cloven Elders. And Annabeth and Clarice are already there with Juniper.
Yeah, Juniper.
Who is Grover's girlfriend.
Yeah.
His dryad girlfriend.
I forgot she was introduced this early, too.
I know. But yeah, that was a lovely little moment. Just getting a first glimpse at Juniper and seeing how much she cares about Grover. It's very cute. The council ultimately hears Grover's arguments or whatever, but is ready to basically say, we're taking your searcher's license. Chiron kind of steps in as an honorary member of the council and seems to convince them to give him one last chance. So they are giving Grover 1 week to find Pan, or he's done and he's going to have to become a puppeteer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel bad because I know Grover heard Pan. I believe Grover.
Yeah.
And it's not cool. It's not cool. Council.
I know. How they're described and, you know, they're just so dismissive of him and it's really frustrating.
Yeah.
I can't wait till he proves them wrong.
Grover deserves better.
It's going to be so satisfying.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Another thing that kind of jumped into my brain as I was reading this chapter, I think it's as they're leaving the clearing from the council meeting, Annabeth tells Percy, like, oh, I'll explain that later. I forget what it was. But it was another thing that Percy's asking about, and she's like, oh, I'll explain later. Annabeth keeps doing this, and it's starting to stress me out.
Yeah.
She needs to stop putting off explanations when they have time for them. They were in the car together. She could have talked about what was going on with Clarice. She could have talked about, like, Annabeth, use your time wisely.
Yeah.
I know you are capable of this.
She's being a little petty right now because she's a little mad.
Yeah.
And I think...
It's stressing me out.
Yeah, it's stressing me out, too, because I just want to know what's going on.
Right, like, stop putting off telling Percy things that are going on. Just explain what's going on with Grover, talk about this mystery project, you know, stop keeping him in the dark just because you're a little upset. I get it. Yeah. We get it. And you're young, so it's okay. We'll get through it. But it's just something that kind of jumped out at me. Next, Percy is headed back into camp, and they find out that it's inspection time. So he heads to his cabin, fully prepared to, like, end up doing dishes that night. And Tyson is there.
God, he makes me happy just being on the page, just existing.
Between Tyson, Mrs. O'Leary, and Rachel Elizabeth Dare, I feel like this chapter is, like, just full of sunshine.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I love them. But, yes, Tyson cleaned the cabin, and honestly, Tyson can come clean my house any day. I would also be keen to have him decorate because these little, like, anemones in jars on the windowsill, I'm sure they're cute. And him, like, hanging fish ponies from the ceiling and, like, all that stuff.
I love that Percy was specific to say, like, it's amazing how his big hands can make something so delicate. And I love that.
Yeah, especially with, like, his work at the forges, you think of it as, like, big, brutal, tough, you know, hard work. And to think that, yeah, he's also capable of these delicate little
And there's another, things. Like, dynamic within Tyson that Percy brings up, which is that, yes, he often acts like a child and he has a little bit of a younger mentality, but he's also really smart. And I love that. I love that it doesn't have to be one or the other, and that Rick was sure to point out that, like, okay, just because he might act like a kid doesn't mean that he doesn't know what's going on and isn't, you know, capable of helping or any of that kind of stuff. So the respect that Percy has gained for his brother in the last two books has just skyrocketed, and you can tell how much he truly loves him.
Agreed. And I think it just is further proven in the next, like, scene or two when they go to the dining pavilion and Tyson notices the giant split on the dining room floor, which most of the campers are just walking over. Mm-hmm. Now, Tyson notices it and says something, and Percy kind of, like, starts to hesitate, like, do I need to explain all this to him? And then he's like, no, you know what? He should know. And he tells him, you know, about Nico, and he kind of describes, like, why it's a secret and why it's important, and Tyson gets it. Yeah. Like, he doesn't have to over-explain, and Tyson starts talking about the Titans, and he goes, like, yeah, I get it. And it's just, like, we start to think of Tyson as, you know, he's childlike. He has this innocence, and he doesn't necessarily understand everything Percy says, like, at first glance. Like, the first time he says it, he doesn't always get it. But he's not dumb. It's just because he's processing it differently.
Right.
And so I love that, in this instance, Tyson gets it, and he's on board. Like, he knows.
And in a book about neurodivergency, to have there be a variety of neurodivergencies, I think, is really important.
Agreed. Yeah, it's really cool. So, yeah, we just love Tyson. What else is new? Okay, and the last bit of this chapter is Percy, that night, is having some trouble sleeping, and he sees that the fountain in the corner starts to glow, and it's never done that before, so he gets up to check it out, and it basically says, like, incoming iris message. So it's like somebody's calling collect.
Yeah, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, so he has to pay for the message, and a drachma shows up in the bowl, so he uses it, and it takes him to Nico, who he quickly realizes is camping on the riverbank of the River Styx.
Yes. And he's burning mytho-magic cards to stay warm.
I know. It breaks my little heart.
I was so sad. Like, we've been talking a lot about this nerdy, enthusiastic Nico that we have known so far. And after Bianca's death, he becomes emo Nico. And to see him literally, like, it's not a metaphor. Like, he is literally kind of burning away his old self and becoming this new self. And it's really tragic. And I love the Nico that we have in the future books and everything. I think it's really good to talk about the things that Nico goes through. But, like, it's just after his enthusiasm in the last book, it's very hard to watch.
It's so tragic to literally watch his innocence, like, burning in front of, you know, Percy's watching him just add card after card after card. And it's like,
also, I can't imagine that would make a very big fire. Just saying.
Probably not, but if it's all he's got, you know, it breaks my heart. Yeah. Though. It really does. Okay, so he's on the River Styx, he's burning these cards to keep a fire going. And all of a sudden, there's a voice. Mm-hmm. And Percy realizes that it's a ghost. And we don't know who this ghost is, but they're putting some pretty dangerous and scary thoughts in Nico's head.
Yeah.
Nico just really wants Bianca. Even if he can't bring her back to life, he just wants to be able to talk to her. And I don't know if we've touched on this so far, but it seems like Nico has always been able to, like, talk to ghosts or summon them in some way, shape, or form. Hmm. I know he does later on in the books. Like, he's able to talk to ghosts and use ghosts. But it seems like here he's talking about, I can't even summon her. And I think it's because he's maybe had that ability already in his life. Like, he's realized that he can. And she, for some reason, is being, like, extra difficult.
Maybe. But I also think that ghost said that he helped him figure out his powers. So I assumed that he taught him how to talk to ghosts. Like, maybe he could come up to Nico and then was basically like, I'll teach you. And then
that might be, yeah.
I still agree with you that I feel like that ghost is keeping Bianca away.
Oh, yeah.
Or that she's unavailable for, like, a legitimate reason.
Yeah.
Like, maybe she's in, well, she would probably be in Elysium because she died in battle and she was a good person. So maybe he can't talk to her because of that. But I kind of got the sense that this ghost is keeping her away. Because he's obviously trying to manipulate Nico.
Yeah.
Because, and unfortunately, it's working.
Well, because he is feeding these thoughts into Nico's head and talking about how the only way to get to Bianca and to talk to Bianca is to trade a soul for a soul. Like, if he wants to bring Bianca back, he has to trade a soul for a soul. And not a soul that Hades is already going to collect. Because Nico has already offered his own soul.
Like, without question.
Right. Which, you know, it says something about Nico.
Yeah.
He's already offered his own, and that's not a good enough payment. It has to be a soul that Hades wasn't already going to collect. And this ghost keeps pointing at, like, vengeance for Bianca. And, you know, revenge is how you get her back. And clearly, this ghost is trying to direct him mm-hmm. to, if you can get Percy's soul, we'll give you Bianca.
Right.
And that's dangerous. And
to Nico's credit, he does not like that idea at first. Like,
no.
He is not a fan, and he ends up doing it because it seems like it's the only way, and he just really wants Bianca. But, like, his heart's not in it.
No. You can tell he doesn't agree. He doesn't think it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. But if that's the only way, he's gonna, you know, take it under advisement and see what the next step is, basically. Yeah. I think bigger than anything is, who sent this Iris message?
I know. I was wondering that, too. I really have no idea. I mean, it could have been Hades. Like, it could have been maybe he knows something is going on.
I'm trying to think of who's in the underworld that would, like, Persephone could possibly be down there.
That's a good idea.
And, like, I could see her see this as, like, alarming, and if she's working on the side of the gods, like,
right.
I could see her being like, Percy needs to be aware of this,
right.
And, like, sends an Iris message. I don't know. Definitely something to keep in mind, because someone sent him this Iris message and allowed him to watch this all unfold. And we also don't know who this ghost is.
Right.
And Percy, I don't think Percy even sees him. He just hears the voice.
It's like
and
a flicker, like an outline, but we have no idea who it actually is.
It's also interesting, we should probably keep in mind that if we can figure out who this ghost is, it might inform mm-hmm. what's going on and who they're working for and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear they're probably working for Kronos, because if they can take out Percy, then Nico will be the child of the prophecy, and they can better manipulate Nico than they can Percy, which, poor Nico, like, he just lost his sister, his entire life is upended, he just found out he's a child of Hades, he's got these enormous powers that he's still trying to figure out how to use, and people are already tugging him left and right, and it's just awful that he's having to experience this right now.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Nico is one of the most sympathetic characters in this book, because he starts out so infectiously happy and with
innocent.
A joy for life,
yeah.
And pretty soon everything becomes about death and darkness and all that, so. Okay, that pretty much wraps up this chapter, so let's do our favorite quotes and our favorite moments. I will go first with the quotes. Mine is actually a Chiron quote. He says, it's not good that the she-demons are stirring. And it's just completely out of context. It's hilarious. He was talking about the Empusai, and, like, apparently female demons, like, being stirred up must be a sign of great stirring or something.
Like
the male demons are doesn't take much.
So they're always kind of, riled up.
Right? So they just show up.
She-demons get riled up. But
once the she-demons show up, you're in big trouble. So I just thought that was hilarious. What was yours?
Mine was from Percy when he's thinking to himself, if you've never been charged by an enthusiastic Cyclops wearing a flowered apron and rubber cleaning gloves, I'm telling you, it'll wake you up quick.
Oh, Tyson, we love you.
Love you.
Okay, so favorite moments. Mine was Tyson playing with the quote-unquote little doggy, Mrs. O'Leary. Like, yeah. He just starts, like, he jumps right in and is like, yeah, puppy. And I just think it's adorable. And Mrs. O'Leary and Tyson together is just lovely. And, yeah. Also, in this chapter, Grover was wearing a Got Hooves t-shirt. And I just want the Disney Plus people to, like, take note of that. Because that would be a really fun shirt to be able to buy.
I would wear that.
I would wear that.
Yeah.
Got Hooves. Anyway. And what was your favorite moment?
Tyson being adorable and cleaning up the cabin. I love him so much.
It's such a great introduction for Tyson in this chapter, like, in this book, because, you know, we didn't see a ton of Tyson in the last book, but to see him here, it's just like, oh yeah, Tyson's back, yeah, I love him, yeah. Okay, so that wraps up our chapters for this week. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at subjectifymedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can email us your long-form thoughts at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms as well. Please consider leaving a review or a 5-star rating. They really help others to find us, and that is wonderful. You can leave us questions or comments in any of these places, or ideas for content you might want to see, or an episode idea. We'd love to hear those, so feel free to reach out. We did have some feedback this week. Karen, do you want to handle the email we got?
Yes. So this email is from our friend Quiva, who is from Ireland, and I remember her because of her cool name, so that just made me excited. But she wrote, hello, just wanted to say my thoughts on the casting for Annabeth and some other things, too. Annabeth is my favorite character, so I was waiting in anticipation to see who was going to be cast. I love who they cast so much. For me, if they cast somebody who looked more like Annabeth in the book, I wouldn't have liked it as much, since I have that image and it probably wouldn't ever be exactly the same. But since Leah is so different than Annabeth in the book, it's really good, if you know what I mean. The fact that Leah is only 12 and people aren't supporting the casting and her is just so sad and gross. She's going to be amazing. It's been really cool hearing about all the different gods and different myths I haven't heard before. I think it would be very cool if you did Aphrodite or Athena, as most people haven't heard their stories as much. We definitely have plans to do all the gods, so don't worry about that.
We were just trying to get the ones we figured would be cast first, done first. Yeah. So yes, there are plans to do others.
Definitely, definitely. Since lots of news and fan art is coming out about the Percy Jackson series, I've been pondering getting Twitter or Instagram. On which app do you think I would see more fan art and hear more news? Well, here's the unfortunate answer for you. If you want to see more art, probably Instagram. If you want to see more news, probably Twitter.
Yeah.
So I would say, I mean, if you're keeping up with news with us, then we gather everything from Twitter. So if you're leaning more toward about fan art, I would say go to Instagram, because there's some really cool. There's a lot of art on Twitter, too, though.
Yeah, and I think if you know, as you get into social media and get into Instagram, if you keep an eye on, like, hashtags and stuff, you can probably get a good idea of the news that's going around too from Instagram. So if fan art is like a thing you're really into, there's not a ton on Twitter, but there's definitely more on Instagram. So yeah.
I think
that's a solid recommendation.
She also writes, since you are not quite but nearly finished the Percy Jackson series, will you move on to the Heroes of Olympus and then Trials of Apollo? Spoiler alert, no. We're actually going to be talking about Kane Chronicles next, because we want to get the first book in before the movie comes out. And I actually haven't read that series in a very long time, and I really want to get to it.
And I actually haven't read that series.
Yeah.
Just put a period at the end of that thought, because I just never got around to them. I got into the Percy world and read Percy and Heroes of Olympus and Trials of Apollo, and then Magnus came out, and I haven't even finished that one, I don't think.
You haven't finished Magnus?
I don't think I read the last one.
Oh my gosh.
And so I got confused. There's a lot of stuff going on. And so I haven't read the King Chronicles at all. So I think it'll be an interesting dynamic with Karen, who hasn't read them in a long time, and me, who hasn't read them at all.
I'll throw my secret shame out into the world, which is that I never actually read the last Kane Chronicles book.
See, so I think, going through those will be fun.
It'll be really different for us.
I literally will not remember any of it because I don't know any of it.
Only three books in that series. We'll get through it quick, and then we'll probably do Heroes of Olympus after that.
I think that's pretty much the plan. So
she also says, I love listening to your podcast so much, and whenever a new episode comes out, I want to listen to it straight away. Can't wait to listen to the next episode. Keep doing what you're doing. From Quiva. Thank you.
We appreciate it. We really do love hearing from you guys, so thank you very much.
Yes.
We also got a tweet during our last Olympian week. Her handle was New Rachel, which is at RachelJoy23. And I'm not going to read her tweet right now, but she reminded us that we should do a what if episode for Titan's Curse. We hadn't necessarily forgotten. We just hadn't really gotten there.
I forgot. I'll say it. I completely forgot. Thank you, Rachel, for telling us.
We've had some, we're planning the next month or so worth of episodes and trying to think of what we need to fit in where and all that stuff.
Our schedule is insane.
Yeah, and it kind of got away from us. So, yes, we will be doing a what if episode coming up at some point for the Titan's Curse. But thank you for reminding us, because we might have forgotten about it and we would have gotten upset about forgetting later. Yeah,
I would have. Kristen would have reminded me eventually, but I totally would have forgotten.
Yeah. It was just not at the front of my mind. I think I always knew, we have to do that, but it was not at the forefront. So we really appreciate that, and we will probably, as long as we don't forget, include your what ifs in that episode. Yes. So just hold on. But thank you for your input. We appreciate it. And lastly, there is another tweet. Karen, do you want to do that one?
Sure. This is from Ian Davies at Ensign Davies, who says, just started listening to Prophecy Podcast, and now I need to catch up. I'm loving the news, and now my book list has increased a lot, and I'm really enjoying the chapter reviews. Thank you, Ian. We love getting new listeners, and we love hearing what you guys like, because then we'll keep doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, really great hearing from you guys. So thanks again. Okay. So next week, we're going to take a little break.
Don't panic.
From all things Percy, but only for a week.
Yeah.
And only for one episode. Because we're going to be talking about Ballad and Dagger. And we have a little interview that we're going to be doing with Daniel Jose Older. And so we're deciding to kind of put the Battle of the Labyrinth reading on hold for 1 week so that we can get all of our Ballad and Dagger thoughts into one episode. We'll do our discussion of the book in addition to the interview with Daniel all in one. So if you have a busy week, take a breather.
You have an extension on your homework.
You're two chapters. You have 2 weeks to read those two chapters. So you get a little bit of a break. But yeah, we're really looking forward to talking with Daniel and getting into Ballad and Dagger. So that'll be a lot of fun. Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.